I have a message from another time. Airy Productions Unlimited presents Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword, Fifth Movement, Roses in Springtime, by Benjamin D. Hutchins. Hi, that would be me. With Chris Overstreet. 11:51 a.m. Eastern Time. Sunday, March 20th, 2405. Worcester Preparatory Institute, Worcester, Massachusetts, Earth. Caitlin Hutchins wasn't quite awake, but she was awake enough to be aware of that fact. It was a most enjoyable sensation, knowing that she was in her own bed, not quite awake, with no reason to change that situation. She turned over, hugged her favorite stuffed tiger a little tighter, and burrowed down, smiling to herself. It was just the kind of not awakening that meant she could go back and finish that pleasantly semi-erotic dream with a good chance of actually remembering it when she did wake up. Paris had been lovely, but it was good to be home. She woke again in half an hour, this time fully, brightly awake. Her plan to cheat jet lag by staying up all night had been a success, and she felt a little smug about that as she climbed down out of her top bunk, put on her glasses, and surveyed Morgan 412 in the dim light that filtered through the closed blinds. Her roommate, Utena Tenjo, was still asleep, which Kay thought was quite decadent, given that the girl had been in bed and showed signs of having been there for some time, when Kate got home at 2:15. Kate considered rousting her, decided it would be cruel. From the look on her face, maybe she was having a nice morning dream as well. Instead, Kate quietly got fresh clothes from her bureau, put them up on her bunk, and then went to get her bathroom things from her suitcase. This led to a revelation that she found slightly intriguing, slightly amusing, and slightly unsettling all at the same time. When she'd arrived home from Paris in the wee hours of this morning, she'd been bone tired. She'd come into the room without turning on any lights, dropped her suitcase and duffel bag on either side of her just inside the door, taken her pajamas and Seven the Tiger out of her duffel, and gone to bed without doing much in the way of investigating the room around her. As such, she hadn't noticed that she'd come within about 4 inches of plunking her suitcase down on her brother Corwin's head. "What are you doing here?" she asked his unconscious shape quietly. Then, shrugging, she moved her suitcase away from him and opened it up to get her toothbrush and stuff. They were both awake when she got back from the bathroom, sitting in the two battered but serviceable armchairs Kate and Utena had bought at Worcester's Salvation Army thrift store, and talking. As Kate entered Morgan 412, they got up, smilingly welcoming her home. Kate accepted their welcome with good cheer, then threw Corwin out into the hall so she could get dressed. While he was out there, she asked Utena, "Taking a chance, aren't you?" Utena looked puzzled. "Huh? Oh, you mean Corwin? Nah, it's fine. Janice is okay with it. Alverson's been away since Thursday. Some kind of family thing. He won't be back until tomorrow." Carol Alverson, freshman, was Morgan Forth's duly designated Broadbank toady. With her gone, resident advisor Janice Barlow's assessment that the coast was clear for Corwin to stay was probably right, but still, it was a bit chancy. It would have been one thing with Caitlin there, but with her absent, the whole thing took on different connotations. On the other hand, he had been on the floor. Not that an outside observer seeing him enter but not leave the room could tell where he was sleeping. All that played out in fairly plain fashion on Kate's face as she dressed. As she interpreted it, Utena didn't become indignant or defensive, only serious. "He's had a rough week," she said. "One of his classmates at Crescent Heights died Wednesday." Kate blinked, horrified. "What?" Utena nodded and told her the whole story. There wasn't much to tell, just that Corwin's classmate Kala had been murdered Wednesday night. By her own mother, no less. She'd asked Corwin to come over and help her with her homework, but being tired, he'd some other time and gone home to have a nap instead. Thus, when it happened, He'd blamed himself. So he came here. Dad must have known, but he didn't mention it. Probably didn't want to worry me on my birthday. That's why he was here Thursday night. Yeah, he was going to go back Thursday morning, but after breakfast we decided it'd be better if he stuck around here for the weekend. Hordes of grief counselors and whatnot at the Heights. Kate understood. She and her brother shared an aversion to being counseled by strangers, preferring to discuss their problems with their family and friends or keep them private as the situation warranted. In a crisis like this one, Corwin would do anything he could to avoid the sympathetic strangers sure to be swarming around his school, and instead seek solace in his own way. Under normal circumstances, that would probably have meant vanishing rather unhealthily into his underground workshop for several days. But since Utrina entered both their lives, nothing was quite normal anymore, was it? Caitlin smiled at the thought, left it unvoiced, and went to let him back into the room. He'd washed his face, his bangs were damp, and brushed his teeth while he was waiting. Kate said she hoped they hadn't kept him waiting too long. Corwin grinned. Nah, I was just... There was a soft knock at the door. Kate went to answer it and found Dorothy. Good morning, Caitlin, said she. Morning, Dorothy, said Kate. Come on in. Thank you. The robot girl crossed the threshold, shut the door behind her, then handed Kate a small package. This is for you, she said. Birthday greetings, albeit belated ones. Kate smiled. Thank you. Yeah, now that you're up, come on. You got a ton of loot here. Utrina indicated a pile of wrapped packages on the floor by the feet of the bunk beds. Let's go down to the wedge, get the gang together, and have a little party. This they did, and the gang turned up in force, crowding the biggest wedge booth and piling the table with gaily wrapped presents. Moose McEachern appropriated one of the wedge's trash barrels, bringing it over and removing the swing gate lid to make throwing away the wrapping paper and such as easy as possible. Not all the packages were brightly colored. A couple had come in the mail, and so sported the standard blue and silver colors of Federated Express. There was also a stack of cards and envelopes, some with postage, most without. Kate started on those, beginning with the stamped ones, since they were most likely from people who weren't present in person. Ah, she said, smiling at the first one. It was a thick card in a heavy cream-colored envelope, addressed in the most astoundingly regular, peculiarly angular handwriting Utrina had ever seen. Kate carefully opened the end and drew out the card. It was also creamy in color, and marked with golden script in a language Utrina didn't recognize. Kate let out a surprised little sound, then opened the card. The inside was also marked with the same alien script, with more of that almost machine-precise handwriting, this time in the same alien language. Below, then what looked like a signature. "What is it?" asked Zionji. "It's a card from Professor Stuvek," said Kate with a fond smile. "I'm not sure what it says. I'll have to translate it later." "Professor Stuvek sent you a birthday card?" said Azalin in a surprised tone. Then she smirked a little. "So much for Kolinar." "I don't think he was ever a candidate for that," said Kate with a grin. At Sionji's continued look of confusion, she explained, "Professor Stuvek was the Vulcan teacher here, but before the Vulcan government recalled all their nationals over Christmas." "And Kate was his teacher's pet," said Amanda Dessler with an air of amusement. "Amanda, I was not," said Kate with good-humored indignation. "I did do pretty well in his class, though, and he appreciated that." She smiled, slightly embarrassed, and said, I guess I have to Dad's gift for languages. That, and Professor Stuvek is really an old softy at heart, said Azalin with a grin. She reached into her shirt and pulled a small, gleaming thing out on a chain. It was a medallion, its main body silver, circular and about an inch across, with a golden triangle offset against it at an angle, its base protruding beyond the circle. There was a small diamond set into this medallion at the upper point of the triangle. He gave me this. What is it? Asked Dutina. An idic. It's a Vulcan philosophical thing. Infinite diversity in infinite combinations. One time after class we got to talking about my religion's philosophical disciplines. He gave me that look Vulcans do. I can't really describe it, but when you meet one someday you'll understand, and said... And here, Azalin adopted what Caitlin recognized as a pretty good impression of Professor Stuvek's dry, pedantic tones. You, Miss Devere Natashkin, are living proof of the value of the Idic doctrine. What does that mean? Utina wondered. Got me, Azalin replied with a grin, dropping the pendant back into her shirt. I think Vulcans use diverse as a euphemism for weird a lot of the time, but Professor Stuvek likes weird, or he wouldn't have come to teach here. She sighed, looking a little glum. I miss him. His classes were hard, but he was really fair, and he'd have loved to meet Dorothy. Well, maybe the situation will cool down some, and he'll be able to come back. Maybe. Anyway, it's nice to know he's keeping in touch. Is there a return address on there, Kate? I'll have to write him. Kate nodded, dealt with the rest of the cards, and then started opening packages. She started with Dorothy's, which seemed only fair, since its presentation to her upstairs had triggered this whole gathering in the first place. Oh, my, said Kate as she freed the small object from its packaging, held it in the palm of her hand, and looked at it. Dorothy, it's beautiful. The robot looked very faintly relieved. I'm glad you like it, she said. Corbin has told me of your fondness for timepieces. The style was a guess. Caitlin smiled and turned the pocket watch over in her hands, placing it across her palm. It was hunter-cased, completely enclosed in gleaming silvery metal, and when she pressed the stud it didn't open. She looked puzzled and faintly uncomfortable. How terrible Dorothy would feel if there were some problem with her gift, and then realized that there was nothing wrong with the watch. She was simply holding it wrong. She put it in her left hand, and then it sprang open easily, revealing a glowing, semi-projective holographic face. That was so unexpected that she let out a little surprised sound, and Dorothy smiled slightly, gratified. It has many functions, she explained. The documentation is in the box. The case is the only antiquated thing about it. Caitlin closed the watch again and smiled at Dorothy. Thank you, she said. Happy birthday, said Dorothy. Kate tucked the watch into the top pocket of her shirt, making a mental note to get a chain for it. Then she set to opening the rest of the presents. She had thoughtful friends, friends who knew her well. Their gifts weren't extravagant, but they were well chosen, even those of the ones whose friends she hadn't been for very long. Kyuichi Sayonji, for instance, had known her only since the week before Christmas, at which, for their first meeting, they'd engaged in her first life-or-death sword duel, no less. But his gift was perfectly appropriate to the context of their young friendship. A sword maintenance kit, compact and sturdily cased, just the thing for the journeywoman samurai on the go. Azalin quietly cautioned her not to open her gift in front of the others, so with a mixture of curiosity, anticipation, and dread, she slipped the flat little package surreptitiously into her pocket instead. Amanda Dessler seemed to be the only one who noticed. She smirked slightly, but said nothing. From the others, there were books. This was a literate group, with wide-ranging tastes. And they gave each other books quite often. And music, always a good choice for Kate. Moose presented her with a somewhat bulky item, which turned out to be the newest Harlan McCall mystery, only out in steel cover back on Hoffman. It weighed 25 pounds, but it wouldn't be available in any more manageable edition anywhere else in the Federation for 6 months. Kate, being a huge McCall fan, would gladly put up with a book she had to leave lying on the floor in order to read, for the chance to read the newest installment without waiting that long. The two newest duelists, Mia Ausa and the Barsavian Skrang named Skaya, came in a bit late, after she'd finished dealing with the packages and the assembled were all sitting around the bench discussing Paris. Skye had a big, flat package, maybe 2 feet by 3 under one arm. Mia's was considerably smaller, a little square box that fit in her hand. Utna, sitting in the bench beside Kate and presiding over the disposal of the wrapping paper, was still not quite used to Skye. Not that she didn't like him, because she did, but simply because he invariably startled her a little when he appeared. In the world of her birth, there were no thinking creatures that were not human. Or at least, she thought darkly, that did not look human. And Skaya most assuredly was not that. He was roughly humanoid, with arms, legs, and a head in basically the right place. But no human ever had bright blue leathery skin, a head shaped like a pteranodon's, or a powerful, mobile tail almost as long as the rest of him was tall. Mia wasn't quite human either, but she was a lot less startling about it. She was a pretty girl, not a flashy dresser, quiet of demeanor. The only thing about her that was plainly not human was the bony crest that spanned the back of her head, anchored at her temples. And that was only obvious on the days when she had her long, wavy, ebony hair tucked underneath it. The ridge of bone was an inheritance from her Minbari mother, as were her almost translucently pale skin and the slight accent in her speech. The hair had certainly come from her Earthman father. No Minbari had any. "A hearty welcome home to you, Mademoiselle President," said Skaya with a bow, sweeping his feather-plumed hat from his pointy, sunburst-crested head and nearly raking the assemblage with it as he did so. "Please excuse our tardiness, and permit me to extend to you my very best wishes for a happy hatching day." Kate smiled slightly and chose not to point out to her reptilian schoolmate that she was a mammal and hadn't hatched. Skye was certainly well aware of that. It was just that in his native language, hatching and birth were synonyms. "You're not late, she told him. Attendance isn't mandatory, after all," she added with a wider smile. The Skrang slapped his tail heartily against the carpeted floor, his racist equivalent to a barking laugh, and nodded acquiescence. "Nevertheless, we are the last to arrive," he said. "Please accept this with my compliments." He held out the large flat package. "My goodness," said Kate. She took it, tore away the paper, then oriented it properly and admired it. It was a painting, acrylic on Dura canvas, if Kate was any judge, quite nicely executed. It depicted the precise moment at which Elizabeth Broadbank had lost her duel, now famed throughout the student body, with Utna Tenjo, the duel before the president of the Institute which had sealed the charter of the Institute Duelist Society. Utna had been captured exactly at the peak of her great leaping strike, the signature she put at the end of every duel, her long, lean body fully extended, the thorn of the rose pointing her way forward like a gleaming black finger. Skaya's eye for detail was excellent. The look of determination on Utna's face was perfectly rendered, her azure eyes almost alive, and the scarlet runes glowing along the thorn's blade were accurate. "Oh, my," said Kate. "This is lovely." "You flatter me," said Skaya with another graceful bow. "The arts are very important on my homeworld. In ancient times they were the only way in which people could tell whether they could trust in one another. It's still said on Barsave that a man whom the muses cannot make use of is already the tool of something else." "Well," said Kate with a smile, I think it's safe to assume that you're okay, then." "Good likeness," Utna mused. "I like how you managed to mostly hide Liza behind my hair." "Sadly, I cannot take the credit for that," Skye said wryly. "The image is as I saw it. Fortune had already provided that happy circumstance." They all chuckled at that, and Kate set them hinting carefully down on the table. "I'll hang it in our club office," she said. "That way we can all enjoy it." "I guess I'm last," said Mia calmly. Smiling, she presented her package. "Happy birthday, Caitlin." Kate thanked her and opened it, revealing a data crystal. "It's some recordings of ancient Minbari music, mostly by the Yedor Crystal Orchestra," Mia explained. "Some of the pieces date to the earliest days of human civilization. One of them is reputed to have been composed by Valen himself. I hope you like it." Caitlin smiled. "Minbari crystal symphonies," she exclaimed, delighted. "I heard one when I was five. But recordings are hard to find. Thank you." They cleaned up and adjourned, first to Morgan 412 so Kate could put her things away, then to invade Ping's garden for the celebratory dinner, celebrating both her birthday and her victory over what Jury Riley referred to, when she finally got out of bed, as the forces of cacophony back in Paris. Then it was time for Corwin to go, to head back to New Avalon at last and see about finding a way to resume the routine his life had had before Wednesday. "Before I go," he said as he shouldered the duffel bag he and Utina had bought to hold the clothes he and Utina had bought when it became obvious on Thursday that he wasn't going home, "there's something I have to see." He grinned at Kate. "And you know what it is." Kate went red. "Oh, come on, Corwin, she said, but he shook his head implacably, the grin still in place. Kate sighed, shoulders slumping in defeat. "Okay, fine, she said. Wait outside." Corwin obediently went outside, closing the 412 door behind him and leaning against it, looking thoughtfully across the hall at the closed door to 413, Dorothy and Jury's room. As he did so, the door to 411 opened, and Janice Barlow, Morgan Forth's resident advisor, looked out. Seeing him standing there with his bag over his shoulder, she smiled faintly. "Headed home, finally?" she asked. "Yep, in a few minutes," he replied. "Listen, thanks for not giving me a hard time this week." Janice waved it off. "I'm not your mom," she said carelessly. "I don't have to keep you honest if there's nobody around who'll complain." Corwin reddened. "It wasn't," he said, but Janice laughed. "Yeah, I know," said the RA. Then she gave him a speculative look and added, "And damned if I don't believe you for some reason. Crazy world, isn't it?" The door to 412 opened, almost spilling Corwin back inside. As he regained his balance, he turned to see Utina, almost convulsed with laughter, leaning out through the gap. "Okay," she said between chortles. "It's ready. Come on and see." "Take it easy, kid," said Janice. "Have a nice flight home." Corwin thanked her again and went back into 412. Janice smiled and went back into her own room. "Nice kid. A little obvious, but who isn't at that age?" Her datacom terminal was beeping at her. New mail, she supposed. She sat down and punched up the message. Return path, Durandal at durandal.wpi.k12. Date, Sunday, 20 March 2405, 1402:20-05 ET. Ex-sender, Durandal at localhost.localdomain. To Janice Barlow, jbarlow at wpi.k12. Subject, preliminary. The body of the message was garbled, some letters replaced by random alphanumeric or punctuation characters. It took Janice a few moments to work out what it said. Durandal 1707, incoming message from Durandal. "I understand from your file that you're from Ragal Colony. and a licensed hunter in your spare time. Remarkable what some people will choose as hobbies, but that's neither here nor there. What's important to me is what that means you possess. Powerful weapons, sturdy armor, and a certain healthful disregard for constituted authorities. I may have need of all those things fairly soon, so keep your calendar open. Yours in Kalidor, and boy, it's dark in here. Durandal. Then there was a bunch of garbled code, error messages, and an end of transmission. What the hell? Janice muttered, scratching her head. Corwin paused by the door of his antique Griffin limousine, wiped the last of the tears from his eyes, and said, "Oh, boy. Poor Kate." "She's a sport," said Utina. "What an outfit. I can't believe you actually got your aunt to make a new one." Corwin grinned. "Aunt Belle probably thinks Kate wanted it. It's a shame she wouldn't show us Aunt Erd's version, though." Utina gave him a skeptical look. "That's your sister you're talking about there, pal." Corwin shrugged. The look on her face when she opened the package was worth it all by itself. You should have seen Aunt Belle when she was packing them. Erd, dear, I don't think Caitlin sleeps in that sort of thing." "Yeah, well, sleeping's not the point of wearing this outfit to bed. You're a married woman, sis. You ought to understand that." And then poor Belle got all red and flustered. I thought Mom was going to laugh until she passed out. He shook his head, chuckling. "I don't think Aunt Belle's ready for us kids to grow up. Luckily, she's got a few years before Mirai's dating age. Hiroshi's socially hopeless." "Not a very nice thing to say about your favorite cousin," Utina chided him. Another shrug. "It's the truth. He's worse with girls than I am, and you of all people ought to know what that means." Utina laughed lightly and whacked him on the shoulder. Then, becoming serious, she let her hand rest there and asked him, "You going to be okay?" "Yeah, I'll be fine," he replied. Tentatively, he raised his own hand and covered hers on her shoulder with it. Then he smiled, a mixture of pain and light in his clear blue eyes, and said, "Listen, thanks. I don't know what I just feel really lucky that you're my friend and all." Utina smiled fondly and pulled him into a hug. "So do I," she murmured, rubbing her hands up and down his back. "So do I." They separated after a few seconds, and Corwin got into his car with only a slight air of reluctance. "Have a safe flight," Utina told him, leaning into the window. "Say hi to Nall for me, if he's speaking to you." "He usually has a fit when I run off and leave him by himself," Corwin acknowledged. "But I think this time he'll understand." "I hope so." Utina looked as if she might have something else to say, if she could only think of it. Apparently failing, she tapped the palm of her hand ineffectually against the window combing. Then, with impulsive quickness, she ducked her head, leaned inside, and kissed his cheek. "Clear skies, Corwin," she said, smiling, as she backed out again. "Walk in glory, my beloved," Corwin replied in Old Norse, then drove away, secure in the knowledge that she had no idea what he'd just said. Utina watched him go, then turned and went inside, humming. Caitlin was still wearing it when she got back to Morgan 412, which made Utina laugh again as she entered. "Show's over," she said. "You can take it off now." Caitlin was dressed like a tiger. Not just wearing a tiger-striped garment, she did that every day. Her three identical sets of pajamas were all patterned like the great cat's. No, this was different. This garment was actually made to look like a tiger, or at least a rather cartoony stuffed animal version of one. It was complete with a white underbelly, paws, a tail, and a hood which was surmounted by ears, button eyes, and a whiskery muzzle. Corwin's Aunt Belle Dandy had made the first such sleeper for Caitlin when she was a little girl of 10. Now, 6 critical years later, she'd scaled the design up and made it again. It had much the same effect on 16-year-old Kate as it had had on 10-year-old Kate, which was to say it was utterly adorable. And though Kate had submitted to Corwin's demand that she wear it before he left with a show of reluctance, he was really quite pleased with it in a silly, nostalgic sort of way. Anyway, it was comfortable, warm, soft, and fuzzy. She climbed up into her bunk and sprawled out, one more tiger among the tigers. I'm keeping it on, she replied. I'm not going out again today. It's a sleeper. I'll sleep in it. Utina chuckled and lay down on her own bed to do some reading for her required foreign language course. Kun wij vitu ihakbe ka. Up in her bunk, Kate leafed through the stack of birthday cards again, taking another look at them before she hauled out her Vulcan dictionary and translated Professor Stuvek's card. It was a good assortment, some direct, some funny, none of them particularly schmaltzy. One of them was a bit of a puzzle, though. It was a simple one. White envelope, white card, plain block printing. Thinking of you on your birthday. The inside was devoid of pre-printed notions, but bore a handwritten note written by a hand she didn't recognize. Ms. Broadbank really ought to know better than to leave her father's credit card number taped to her workstation. I was going to short-sheet her bed, but then I thought you'd better appreciate Liza going absolutely spare when she receives the 100-weight box of triple chow she ordered. Not as spare as your father will when he gets the bill, though. Happy birthday, Miss Hutchins. Kate regarded it for a few more moments, trying to decide who it was from, then shrugged, put it back in its envelope, and climbed down to seek out her Vulcan dictionary. If it was true, she certainly was looking forward to that. "Why didn't I see you in the wedge for Kate Hutchins' birthday party?" Jacron asked his roommate, who was as usual immersed in his advanced physics textbook. "Was that today?" Mac mumbled, scribbling something on her notepad as he stared intently at one particular equation. "Of course it was today!" Jacron shouted. "She returned from Paris this morning. Classes resume tomorrow. When else would it have been?" "Oh," Mac muttered. "Sorry I missed it. I did send her a birthday card, though." "Well, that's good anyway." Jacron nodded, turning his attention to matters more worthy of his righteous fury. Tuesday was a beautiful spring day in Worcester. Yes, you heard that right. Utina Tenjo had just escaped early from her last morning class, the staggeringly boring, except when mind-bendingly difficult, Calculus 1, Part 4, The Revenge Continues, and was enjoying a few moments of freedom in the wedge before lunchtime. Several of her friends were assembled in Wedge Booth Number 1, waiting for the Morgan Hall Dining Commons to open its doors, and she was standing by the end of the bench, telling them about the somewhat unfortunate chain of events that had caused Professor Farr to call off the class in the first place. "So by now," she said, "he's been working his way around the blackboards in the whole room, right? He's on the fourth wall, and almost to the end of that one, when suddenly he stops with this perplexed look on his face and says, 'Oof!'" "Oof" was not, in fact, what Professor Farr had said upon realizing that he had made, somewhere back on the first of his classroom's four blackboard-covered walls, a computational error that had invalidated everything else he had spent most of the class period writing on the walls. The sound he had made was rather more like "Hrmph." "Hrmph," however, was not the kind of sound that Utina Tenjo made when someone yelled her name and jumped on her back. She was a strong, sturdy girl, tall for her age and athletic, so she kept her feet, but with such a burden so suddenly imposed, she said, "Oof." Then she scowled a little and started to say, "Azalin, do you mind?" before realizing that she was, in fact, looking at Azalin Devere Natashkin right now, which made it somewhat impossible for the Dantrovian girl to be on her back as well. So she scanned her mental files for some more appropriate interjection and fell back on the old standby. "What the hell?" "Utina, my love," said a voice in her ear. This voice was so unexpected that despite its extreme familiarity, it took her several seconds to place it, by which time it had gone on to coo, "I've come back to you at last," as its owner nuzzled the side of Utna's neck. Utna whirled, which didn't do much good, given that her interlocutor was hanging on her back like a koala on a tree, arms around her neck, legs around her waist. It was a very familiar weight she felt in terms of size, distribution, and general contour, except for the hard something jabbing her back a bit outboard of her left kidney. It was heavier and a bit more substantial area-wise than Azalin, the only one of her friends in this world who she figured would jump on her back under normal circumstances. That and the voice left her only one conclusion, impossible though it was to verify visually at the moment. Wakaba? The weight disappeared, and Utna felt herself spun around again, this time to face her attacker. It was, indeed, her old friend Wakaba Shinohara, reddish-brown eyes, onion-shaped chestnut hairdo, and all, grinning from ear to ear. Utna looked her up and down in an instant, taking her in from head to foot, and then sprang back out of sheer instinct, uttering a sound of surprise and consternation. She had only seen Wakaba dressed like this, in a double-breasted brass-button jacket and snug white trousers, once before, and on that day the girl had been out of her freaking mind. She noticed in her second, longer look that Wakaba was carrying a sword, too, a katana, thrust through the brown leather belt of her trousers. It was that, then, which had been poking Utna in the back. Her left hand dropped reflexively to the hilt of her own blade. "Aw, no," said Utna, her voice a mixture of unpleasant surprise and suspicion. "What are you doing here?" Wakaba's grin disintegrated, replaced by an irritated scowl. She put her hands on her hips, glared at Utna, and replied, "Aw, no? I nearly get my cute little hide punctured for love of you. I come all the way to wherever the hell we are, just to see if you're safe, and all you can say is, 'Aw, no?' Well, if that doesn't just beat everything." She folded her arms. "So much for 5 years of friendship, I guess." Utna blinked. "Wait a second," she said. She relaxed from her defensive posture, stepped back toward her friend, and said, "You mean you're not... You came here on purpose?" "Duh," Wakaba replied, looking irked. "I didn't just trip and fall into a rift in the fabric of space and time. Hello."
But...
Utna stared at her in mingled amazement and bafflement.
"Then how did you get here?"
"The midget sent me," Wakaba said, "to see if you're okay. Which, obviously, you are." The auburn-haired girl looked Utna up and down, a slow, appraising scan, and then smiled, raising an eyebrow. "Interesting look. I see you're still on that out-guy-the-guys thing." She leaned nearer and poked her friend with an elbow, murmuring, "Love the tie." Utna took a step back, looking a little embarrassed, and then discarded that embarrassment and her lingering startlement at Wakaba's sudden appearance, throwing her arms around her oldest friend in a powerful hug.
"Now that's more like it,"
said Wakaba smugly as she returned the embrace.
"Sorry," said Utna, looking a little sheepish, as she and Wakaba released each other. "Well, that's a long story. I'll tell you later. Come on and meet everybody."
She indicated the inhabitants of the booth, who had all risen to their feet.
"This is Moose."
The gigantic, rather ugly, utterly bald, ebony-skinned fellow bowed and rumbled in a tremendous basso voice.
"The Honorable J. Maurice McEachern IV, my lady, at your service."
The little copper-skinned girl next to him, not waiting to be introduced, jumped right up on the table in the middle of the booth, which made her about a head taller than Wakaba. She stuck out a slim, three-fingered hand, not maimed, Wakaba noted, perfectly whole, as if it lacked a pinky by design, and said cheerfully,
"Hi, I'm Azalin. You must be Wakaba. Miki told me about you, but I have to say he downplayed how cute you are."
Thanks, said Wakaba.
"No problem,"
said Azalin. She let go of Wakaba's hand, hopped back to her place in the booth, and winked, grinning.
The blue lizard guy had the most complicated name Wakaba had ever heard, which fled her memory as soon as it was pronounced. Fortunately, he also had an easy-to-remember nickname, Sky, for which Wakaba was profoundly grateful. He seemed like a friendly enough guy for a blue lizard. The blonde guy seemed a little taken aback, but greeted Wakaba quite cordially and informed her that his name was either Carter Devlin or Devlin Carter, and further that she could take her pick, as it didn't matter. He seemed a little distracted about something. Finally, Utina came to the brown-haired girl with glasses, who stood looking pleasant, expectant, and a trifle apprehensive. "And this is Caitlin Hutchins," said Utina, putting her hand on the girl's shoulder. "My roommate and..." She suddenly hesitated, looking a bit worried, and her voice trailed off ineffectually. Wakaba smiled knowingly, hit her gently on the shoulder, and said softly, "It's okay. I've got a higher calling nowadays." She put out her hand in Caitlin's direction. "Nice to meet you. I'm Wakaba Shinohara, Lady Utina's bodyguard." "What?" Utina blurted. "Pleased to meet you," said Kate, shaking her hand and showing a blend of amusement and embarrassment. "What's this about my bodyguard?" Utina demanded. "Later, later," said Wakaba, waving her casually off. "Right now I'm freaking starving. It's something like 10 at night for me right now, and I haven't had anything to eat since dinner except a lemon ice. And I had to fight my first ever sword fight, which I won, by the way, without even a lousy bag of corn chips or anything." She ended this little dissertation, looked around, and spotted the entrance to the grill. "Aha! Just what the doctor ordered. I'll be right back." "Wakaba," said Utina, as Wakaba strode jauntily toward the snack bar, but Wakaba wasn't listening. "Damn," Utina muttered, and went after her as Caitlin giggled into her hand.